89.9 FM HD2 and HD3 Urbana.
This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
Good afternoon. This is Keeping the Faith. Welcome to our program. I am Don Nolan. I'm subbing for Steve Shoemaker. He is taking a long-awaited vacation, and we'll be back in about 3 or 4 weeks. Our topic this afternoon is the world's religions, in particular, issues in teaching the world's religions. And our guest is Professor Jason Merrick, who has been teaching this subject for about 5-6 years at Parkland College.
That's right? Right.
Jason, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me on the show, Don.
We are a call-in show, and if you have questions or comments that you would like to make or questions to put to Professor Merrick, feel free to call in. Our number locally is 333-9455. You also can call in using an 800 number, 1-800-222-9455. All right. Well, let's get right into it. How long have you been teaching this, Jason?
Well, I taught a course in Asian religions in the spring of 1998. I had was a freshly minted master's degree. And then I took a sabbatical to go to graduate school in California, met my wife there, and had started a family. And I've been teaching part-time, I want to say full-time part-time, since around fall of 2003. I've taught religions, great religions of the world, Religion 102, for, I think, 5 years, each semester, 2 sections per semester, and teaching over the summers as well. Mm-hmm. And I also teach Religion 121, which is Religions of the East. So I've been teaching for a while. I enjoy it.
How'd you get interested in religion in general, and in particular the world's religions?
For me, I was almost born with an interest in religion. I was raised in a conservative Lutheran home. My dad was an ex-Catholic who had a real attraction for like Pentecostals. And so in the late 70s and early 80s, my dad was very interested in Pentecostals. And we took, I remember it as an 18-month or so hiatus from my mom's, it was primarily my mom's Lutheran church, and went on a tour of various Pentecostal churches in my hometown of Decatur.
For 18 months?
18 months, roughly. It may have been much less than that, but I think I was 8 or 9 years old, and the rootlessness seemed, and the conversations, I remember my mom and dad having the intense conversations, maybe it made it seem like 18 months, but that was my first introduction. World religions, I saw a book on Buddhism in our church library of all places, and saw one of the images probably of Avalokiteshvara, the 10,000 arms and 10,000 faces, and thought, wow, what in the heck is that? And that piqued my interest, and I've been interested in what people believe ever since.
Mm-hmm. Well, you yourself, how would you identify your own religious preferences?
Well, I am currently attending the First Mennonite Church in Urbana, Illinois. I have a powerful heart connection to Jesus Christ, and I'm developing more of an intellectual connection with Christianity, which I now recognize after 20-some years is not this monolithic one-size-fits-all entity, but in fact there are lots of shades of Christianity and lots of Christianities out there. I'm also a member of the local Unitarian Universalist community. I engage in a regular meditation practice that comes out of the Buddhist traditions I've studied. And the way that I understand Christianity is fairly idiosyncratic. A lot of my understanding of Christianity is informed by what I know of Buddhist traditions.
Do you sit by yourself or you sit with a group?
I typically sit by myself. Mm-hmm. I've sat occasionally with the Prairie Zen Center in Champaign. I enjoy that, but I find Zen is a little too intense for me. The traditions I have experienced most come from the Tibetan Buddhist traditions, and there seems to be more of an emphasis on It's a slightly looser approach than mm-hmm. Zen is. Mm-hmm. So if my leg hurts after 20 minutes, it's easier for me to adjust it in the traditions I'm familiar with than it would be in the Zendo, for example.
So you have, in your own understanding, been able to put together in your religious experience a religion, Christianity, that is deeply rooted in dogma and belief, and in a Eastern tradition that is more focused on experience. How has that worked for you?
The first question I have is, I don't know that it works all the time. Mm-hmm. There's constantly an intellectual tug of war inside, you know, trying to get the pieces to fit, wondering if it's important that the intellectual pieces fit, wondering if it's enough that I approach this ongoing endeavor with a sense of good faith, that I'm attracted to the beliefs I'm attracted to, and I have a certain personal spirituality that I wrestle with. So whether it works or not is in question.
Well, you're about as close a fit to the title of our program as I can recall, called Keeping the Faith. So you're going to help us figure out what that title means, I hope.
I will do my best.
All right. Well, let's talk a little bit about this discipline, world religions. It's had a rather interesting and sometimes problematic history in academic settings. It was rooted in mostly religious schools, as I understand, when it was first taught. And I understand that your particular commitment to it is largely a focus on religious literacy. What is religious literacy?
Let me answer by way of a story to illustrate the opposite of religious literacy. I had a student in the fall of 2003, and we were talking about afterlife situations that involved some kind of new re-embodiment. And specifically, we were talking about reincarnation or rebirth, the idea that when you die, you instead of going to a permanent afterlife, some traditions like Hinduism and Buddhism tend to discuss the afterlife in terms of rebirth, that it's cyclical. And so I had a student who said that the entire idea of being re-embodied made no sense to her as a Christian. And I said, well, do you recite the Apostles' Creed in your church on Sundays? And she said, well, I do. And I said, well, what about the line in the third section of the Apostles' Creed that says, we believe in the resurrection of the body? That sounds to me like there's some kind of embodiment involved. And a lot of early Christian arguments, theological debates, to my knowledge, were revolved around the question of whether or not one is physically, in some sense, resurrected. And she had recited this creed every Sunday for most of her adult life and had never before heard the phrase resurrection of the body and thought about what that meant. And so she said she was going to go ask her pastor to explain it to her. But to me, that was the opposite of religious literacy, having this lifelong commitment to a faith tradition without ever having really paid attention with your intellectual mind to the words that you're saying every Sunday as part of that tradition. Mm-hmm. So it's no, I guess the nutshell answer is religious literacy is knowing something about the doctrines and practices that you engage in and that what your neighbors engage in if they worship differently than you do.
If you live in a religiously homogeneous society, that might just be learning what your neighbors who are like you in your religious tradition.
Sure.
I take it that by your neighbors you mean people with other
I do. Which in fact, I'm discovering whenever I scratch the surface on a religious believer and I talk to them about what they believe, sooner or later I'll bump into things that are distinctive to that person. Mm-hmm. So even then, I think most people, if they talk about what they believe, will discover that at subtle levels it's different from what the people around them believe.
Well, what if someone said to you, and I'm sure students have said this to you, Intellectually, I don't really need to examine my faith. I should believe first, and then I'll understand, and I just that's all I need to worry about. So why are you trying to get me to doubt and question? Is this just going to lead to undermining my faith? Do you get that response?
I do. I do get that response. I have several thoughts, and whether I can articulate them all here is up for grabs. One response is that if most of my students that I have are from Protestant backgrounds. I have a few students this semester from Catholic backgrounds. Every once in a while I have a Muslim or a Buddhist, but it's typically Protestant. And I've long thought Protestantism puts a really strong emphasis on the correctness of the content of what you believe. Mm-hmm. It's not just that you belong to the Mother Church and you participate in sacraments, although there's an element of that in some Protestant churches. There really is an impetus to believe the right thing. And so I say, if you're a Protestant, it would seem to me incumbent on you to have some intellectual curiosity so that you can make sure that what you're believing is the right content. So that the Protestants that would say believing is enough for me, I think there's arguably they're at risk of believing the wrong thing. Mm-hmm. And you see this often when Protestants get into conversations about the differences in their beliefs. They can really strongly adhere to what it is they were taught, but sometimes they don't know why, or they don't understand even for themselves why something makes sense in a particular way.
Well, there are many, aren't there, who have highly articulated defenses or apologies or rationales for their beliefs, but they still are relatively unreflective about those beliefs. You can explore your theology if you didn't know it before, but not necessarily become more able to interact, understand, and appreciate the beliefs of others that are radically different from you. Isn't that true?
I think that is true. My hope for my students is that, and I saw a presentation by Dr. Robert McKim, who's a professor of religious studies on this campus, and he was talking about an idea that he had about religious ambiguity, that the world is actually so full of information and so full of evidence. It's full of evidence for everyone's religious claims. And so one of the elements that's needed with this approach, this academic approach, is that students can develop a sense of humility, a sense of recognizing that there are limits to our knowledge. And so although I may strongly believe that Christ is the Savior and it's through his death and resurrection that we're all redeemed, but I think that I have a responsibility to be open to hear what others believe and to hear about their journeys. And the difficulty becomes, well, what about when their journey is different from mine? What about when their relationship to God is different from mine? We can see that as a threat, but in my mind, having faith doesn't mean faith as distinct from factual knowledge. It's we do have a basis of facts that most of us can agree on. Mm-hmm. If those facts challenge what you believe in, that there's an element of faith means wrestling with those challenges and wrestling with those doubts. It doesn't mean the absence of those doubts. In the same way, fearlessness doesn't mean the absence of fear. It means being with your fear and moving forward anyway.
It's often the case, isn't it, that Christians or members of other faith traditions that sign up for your course really don't know that much about their own tradition.
Absolutely.
So why don't we just cut to the chase here? What is so bad about unexamined faith? I mean, people get through their lives just fine without it, even go to their graves. What are the risks?
Well,
this is obviously a principle that is behind why you teach this subject.
Earlier you mentioned that in a homogenous society, religious literacy is not that important. Because I can assume that we all are on the same page, and so knowing the the specifics of the page size and the paper it's printed on, all that stuff is not really relevant. But we don't live in a religiously homogenous society. And arguably, we haven't lived in a religiously homogenous society since the Constitution was drafted. I mean, there was a recognition in the earliest days of the Republic that this was going to be a country where citizens had freedom of belief. And I'm not an American religious historian by any means, but I'm familiar with some of the broader outlines of American religious history. Mm-hmm. And we haven't always lived up to that promise of the First Amendment and of the separation of church and state and of the freedom of conscience and freedom of belief. And it's often challenged when someone who has a really radically different belief than you do moves in next door. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking of Chinese Buddhists in San Francisco and in California often endured having their temples firebombed. I mean, for decades, as houses of Satan and places of devil worship. And again, it was still relatively easy to be religiously illiterate in that environment because most mm-hmm. of the people around you were the same as you. But in 1965, American immigration laws changed, and we amended the immigration to have much higher numbers of immigrants from Asian countries. Mm-hmm. And those immigrants brought with them religions that were profoundly different in many ways from the Judaism and Christianity that mainstream Americans are familiar with.
This kind of jumping ahead here.
Yeah.
In connection with that, what is the fastest growing religion in the United States today? It's not Christian, is it?
I believe it's Islam.
Yep.
And I think it has been for the last decade at least.
And Buddhism has been expanding pretty rapidly too.
It has. It has. My feelings on Buddhism are more, and this will probably offend all my Western Buddhist friends out there, that the attraction to Buddhism is a lot more flavor of the month than the conversions to Islam. That most of the conversions to Buddhism are among, I'll just cut to the chase. They're among white people. They're among folks from Jewish and Christian backgrounds, relatively elite in terms of socioeconomic status. The conversions to Islam, and so there's kind of a cachet in being a Buddhist. And I know because I've had one foot in that tradition for 20 years and I wasn't raised Buddhist. But Islam, I don't know, the conversions to Islam, particularly in a time when it gets such a bad, there's such a bad association, unfortunately and erroneously, with Islam in mainstream media and popular culture.
Since 9/11 particularly.
Exactly. Since 9/11, it amazes me that people are finding something quite powerful in Islam to convert to.
Yeah.
I had the pleasure of speaking to a group of, I think it was the Elks Club or something in Decatur 2 years ago about Islam.
Mm-hmm.
And I talked about how Islam comes from the same Abrahamic roots as Judaism and Christianity. And I just talked about the five pillars of Islam for a little bit and quoted a little bit of Malcolm X and his experience of the Hajj. And afterwards, people were coming up to me afterwards asking if I was a Muslim. Because the tradition is so beautiful that when you present
it, you're a little too eloquent.
Right, exactly. I got caught up in my admiration for Islam. So,
mm-hmm. If you're interested in these questions, you can call in to talk with Professor Jason Merrick. We're talking about world religions and various issues related to its teaching and its role in an academic setting and other issues. The number you can call locally is 333-9455. You can also call an 800 number, 1-800-222-9455. Well, let's just talk a little bit about just how a given religion gets identified as a world religion. How do they get into the textbooks? And why are there some subset of them when hundreds and hundreds of others are either put in a footnote or in an introduction or something else?
Well, you mentioned how do the world religions get classified as world religions and put into a textbook. I think the presence of a text, the presence of some kind of written scripture has tended to be the defining characteristic of what we call world religion.
Mm-hmm.
And so the world religions that I was first familiar with are like the three Abrahamic traditions, so Christianity, Judaism, and Islam. And then the larger traditions like Buddhism, Hinduism, Confucianism, Taoism, and Shinto in Japan. But there are traditions I like to include in world religions like Sikhism and Jainism. Mm-hmm. But I think part of it is that they have a text. I think another thing is that most world religions, most but not all, have fairly sizable populations. Mm-hmm. Some of the not alls in that case include Judaism, which has had an impact on world history and civilization and culture that radically belies the tiny percentage of world population who are Jews.
Right. We have a caller from Eureka on line one. Hello, you're on Keeping the Faith. Your comment or question?
Yes, I was just interested to note that you attended the Mennonite Church in Urbana, and I believe that you said that you still were in some kind of relationship. I believe you said Buddhism. What attracted you to the Mennonite Church, and how do you find dealing with it in other faiths?
Well, this is an example of the response to religion coming from a place other than the head. I have been a member of the Unitarian Universalist Church for a few years, and 2 years ago, a good friend and I decided to do what we called Field Trip Sundays. So one Sunday every other month, we would go visit a neighboring church just to see what things were like. And we attended the First Mennonite Church, and at the service we attended, one of the members of the church, who had been a member of the church his entire life, and I won't say his name on the air, I don't know if I should, so I won't, but he stood up and announced that he had terminal cancer and was going to die, most likely within the next month. And he explained that his faith journey had and family had been the First Mennonite Church through his entire life, that he had been born into the church, and when he got married, he first introduced his wife to the church, and when his son was born, he introduced his son to the church, and now he was going to die in the church. And I saw the entire congregation stand up and move and be with him and be with his family, and my friend and I were invited to be a part of that. And I've had intellectual struggles with Christianity my whole life. I've made peace with my love for Jesus a long time ago, but this experience that was completely from the neck down, it told me that there was something about this particular community that I wanted to experience more of, and so that's what brought me. That was my experience that brought me there.
Houston Smith, another scholar of world religions, once described moving into other faith traditions as making your soul larger.
I think that's a fantastic description. I look to Professor Smith for a lot of insights.
All right. We have another caller from Rand Toole on line one. Hello. You have a comment or question for our guest?
Yeah, Jason, it's good to hear your voice. A former co-worker of yours from PS.
Oh, hi.
Anyway, I am curious, what would you say the value of learning about world religions is to someone like myself who doesn't really trust, I guess is the word, major religions and organized religions in general? I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
Thank you.
I think that's a fantastic question. Part of what it seems like a lot of the assumptions I've been approaching this conversation with thus far is that all my students are religious. And in fact, a lot of my students are not. There's a growing percentage of the American population who is coming out of the secular closet and admitting to themselves and others that they don't believe in anything supernatural, or they don't feel a distinction between what religious people might call the sacred and the profane. Mm-hmm. And I would say I think that studying religions is still relevant and still important for a variety of reasons. One is that you can have a greater appreciation for the civilization that we've inherited, global civilization, but in our particular case, Western civilization. We can appreciate the art, we can appreciate the architecture, we can understand the history, the philosophy, all of the aspects of Western culture that we value, that in higher education we really want to inculcate a love of all of these subjects in students. Studying religion touches on all those and informs our appreciation of all of those things. So you can be an atheist and have a fantastic appreciation for art, and knowing about the religious impulses that drove those artists can enrich your appreciation of that art. The other reason, and it's probably more pragmatic than that, is because most of the people you will interact with on a daily basis do have religious beliefs. And so it's – you can
– something like 95%? According to most polls?
Yeah, some numbers. Mm-hmm. It's like 95% believe in God. But mm-hmm. then you'll see another poll where 20% no, don't believe in God. So I don't know how those numbers mm-hmm. mesh. Mm-hmm. They're probably like me. They have an identity crisis every other day about
There's a mushy area in there.
But I think it just allows you to appreciate the lives of those around you more.
Mm-hmm.
And I had
that's what a part of what you mean by religious literacy. Right?
Absolutely, mm-hmm. absolutely. That it just enriches your understanding of the world around you.
Mm-hmm.
I had atheist friends who've you know said that they don't believe in God, and one of my fun responses as a teacher of comparative religion is to ask which God you don't believe in. Mm-hmm. So that can start lots of fun mm-hmm. conversations too.
We have a caller from Urbana. Hello, you're on Keeping the Faith. You got have a question or comment?
Good afternoon. I'm enjoying the conversation between the two of you, but I had one question. I was leading a seminar on the Apostles' Creed some years ago, and somebody pointed out to me that the early church didn't really settle the question of the physical or spiritual resurrection. They just put in the ambiguous title, I believe, in the resurrection of the body. But Paul spends a considerable time in 1 Corinthians 15, and he's an early writer about the Christian faith, in pointing out that the flesh and blood cannot inherit the kingdom, that the resurrection body is a spiritual body. And this is very specifically and clearly outlined. It is. So the New Testament really gives us two traditions. One is believing in the spiritual body, and the other believing in the physical body's resurrection. I wonder if your guest could talk about that, Don.
Thank you very much.
Well, I'm not a Christian historian, but I think one thing you said there is really powerful and is good information for this conversation, and it's that the New Testament contains both of these elements, the element that there is the support of the notion of the resurrected, like some kind of transfigured new flesh body, and there's also the sense of a spiritual existence after death. I think if you look deeply into any of the ideas that we receive in our society, religious ideas that are monolithic, that say, you know, this is the way that the Bible describes X, Y, or Z. If you scratch the surface, you'll probably find something in the Bible that explains the exact opposite position or a position that is complementary to that. And I think that's because the Bible reflects its nature as an anthology, reflects its nature of being a composite document.
This is true of most of the scriptures of the world.
Absolutely, absolutely. And this is another thing I bring up to students is we don't learn this stuff in church. We don't learn that the Bible is an anthology, is a document compiled over a period of a millennium or more that includes a variety of perspectives.
We have another caller from Champaign, line 2. Hello, you're on Keeping the Faith. Question or comment?
Hi, I have two quick questions. The first is, what text would you recommend that someone who's interested in finding out more about religions read? I'm a cultural anthropologist by nature, and I'm always interested in reading about new religions, just reading about religions in general. So I would be interested in seeing if there's sort of some sort of a survey that one might read. And the other is more spiritual. What does what would you say to those of your friends whom have, shall we say, tried to do the more traditional religious route and have a desire to be more spiritual in their everyday lives, but cannot seem to find something on, you know, within our more regular pantheon of religions to choose from that sort of speaks to them spiritually? Thank you.
Thank you for your two questions. Jason?
I think the first question is easier to answer than the second one. I would recommend, just off the top of my head, I'm not looking at my bookshelf right now, but I would recommend The World's Religions by Professor Houston Smith. That's just a good one to have a nice introduction to the major world religions from an authority who has spent his lifetime trying to develop an understanding of how people within those traditions understand and appreciate their own faiths.
Literally within. He went to most religious centers and sacred places of the world, as I understand.
Indeed, and engaged in various practices with those teachers and those traditions.
Once again, that's
The World's Religions by Professor Houston, and that's Houston without that first O, so it's H-U-S-T-O-N, Smith. Mm-hmm. The other book I would recommend is a book called Our Religions that's edited by Hari Sharma, I believe. I know the last name is Sharma. And it's a pretty thick trade paperback that it includes the seven, what they call the seven major world traditions, a chapter on the history and beliefs by each chapter is by a scholar practitioner within a particular religious tradition. So that's another great way of getting a feel for what people believe.
And the second question on spiritual seeking?
Wow.
It's a tough question.
I feel out of my pay grade on this question.
I don't see a collar on you.
Right, exactly. I would say keep working, keep engaging in conversations with people, keep reading. You know, once you've read the Houston Smith book, find the sections that are most interesting to you and look in the bibliography and see what further reading you can do. Do a field trip Sunday. I mean, I would have never – I encourage every religious and non-religious person listener to one Sunday a year or twice a year, instead of going and playing golf or going to your regular church service or nursing a hangover, whatever it is, go to a new house of worship and see how your neighbors worship. See what they believe. See what they do. And I guarantee you it will do nothing but enrich your own spiritual life.
We have another caller on line 3, I believe it is, from Champaign. Question or comment? Hello, are you still there? Line 3?
Yes, I am.
You have a question for our guest.
Yes.
You might want to turn down your TV.
Yes.
Or your radio, if you're listening on the radio.
My name is...
I'm afraid we lost. Maybe you could call in again in a few minutes. We have another caller on line 1. Question or comment for our guest?
Hello?
Hello, yes.
Hi, this is a former student of Jason's from the fall of 08.
Hello.
Hi, I was wanting to know if you could talk about something that I learned in your class I always found fascinating, and that was from the Jain religion. I think the practice is called Salekhana
or Itvara. This is an interesting practice which is coming under fire in India. Itvara is a – first of all, we'll have to provide a little bit of context for the listeners out there who didn't take my class. Jainism is a religion that comes out of India, and it is what we call a heterodox religion, which means it's the opposite of orthodox. There was a period of religious fervor and foment in India in around the 6th century BC, or BCE, as we say in my class, before the Common Era. And out of this fervor, one of the movements that arose in response to a kind of felt spiritual lack in the Vedic religion of the times was a religion that was called Jainism, which means the path of the victor, the victorious one. And the victor in this case was Mahavira, who had attained victory over suffering by radically reducing his impact on the world around him, on all living things. So he had given up eating meat and was practicing a really radical doctrine of self-denial, and for the monastics, a doctrine of asceticism. And so Salekhana or Itvara is a tradition where a monk or a nun who is terminally ill or who has a debilitating illness or is in another set of circumstances will deliberately, intentionally give up food and will slowly allow themselves to die of starvation. And so it's come under fire in India because it's believed to be a form of euthanasia, lots of ethical concerns, but it is it's a practice that has attestation in Jainism. It's said that that's how Mahavira himself died, was that he basically reached a point in his life where he had run out of his karma. He had purified all of his actions. Every little impact he had made on the world, he had cleared all of his accounts. And so the only thing between him and that final nirvana was his physical body. So that's Itvara.
Well, maybe we'll come back to that. I think our caller from Champagne on line two is back. Hello, you're on Keeping the Faith. Are you there?
Yes, I am. Thank you.
Sorry we had problems earlier.
Okay. My name is Conrad Wetzel, and hello, Jason.
Hi, Conrad.
And I have a question about the evolution of religions. A number of years ago, a professor at the Mennonite Seminary pointed out the way in which ancient Israel, in developing its faith, its monotheism, borrowed from the systems around them. And we are influenced by systems. Could you just give us your perspective on the way in which religions evolve? How has Christianity evolved? How are we evolving toward understanding each other? Anything that you would like to share about that?
Well, I guess I'd start by saying I don't believe in evolution. Just kidding. That's a joke. That's my professor joke. How do religions evolve? Well, I think that there is one aspect that I've noticed in my study of religion is that there tend to be charismatic teachers. Not always, but there tend to be charismatic teachers who find something lacking in the particular religious context that they're a part of. And so they gather around them followers, disciples, who find in that charismatic teacher's words, actions, way of life, precisely that which they felt was lacking. And what's interesting to me is that you see this again and again in Christianity. You see it in Indian religions. You'll have this movement, this kind of radical movement that stirs things up. And then within a few decades to century, that movement, if it survives, becomes institutionalized and becomes more rigid, becomes more legalistic. And then eventually you'll have another charismatic leader who comes along and shakes things up again. And one of the things I've noticed in my study of the religion Sikhism, which is a relative newcomer to the world stage of religions, it's seen by some as kind of a synthesis of Hinduism and Islam out of the 15th century, I think, area of the Punjab in India. And this religion started as nothing more than disaffected Hindus and Muslims coming together as kind of a discussion group, a movement towards religious unity. And within the span of two or three generations, this interfaith dialogue movement had become its own new religion with a city and a huge temple and martial arts. And it became militarized with the ability to defend itself against attacks from the ruling Islamic Mughal powers. And I looked at that and I wondered, what is it about religion, this pattern? Why do we go from the foment to the solidity to the foment to the solidity? And one thing that, I don't know how valid this is, but it's an answer that works for me, is that most of the people who came to see Jesus, or most of the people who went to hang out with Guru Nanak, the founder of Sikhism, were adults. They were people who had been, there's something missing from the religion of their upbringing, and so they were going to look for something new. Well, the next generation comes along, and you have kids who weren't out seeking. You know, the children of the first Sikhs or the children of the first Christians become Christians of their own accord.
They're being religiously educated.
They're being religiously educated. And so within the span of a generation or two, you go from a movement of people who left one thing to found a new thing, and you establish a kind of a new dynasty where your kids and your grandkids grow up believing that dogma and that authority. I don't know if that answers your question, though, Conrad, was more, what do I see the evolution toward the future? I hope and pray that the evolution is in the direction of like the Baha'i faith that says that we are one planet, we are one species, we are one family, and that without those recognitions, we don't survive. I think that religions need to come to that.
There seems to be, to use Lincoln's phrase, better angels in every religious tradition, major religious tradition. There are some, aren't there, though, that you agree that are perverse or even contradictory to the original founder's understanding?
Well,
I mean, if, for example, a Christian tradition advocates hating your enemies, that seems to be pretty directly.
It seems to be pretty opposition to Christ. But then they would probably go back and say, "But if you look in the Book of Joshua, in the Hebrew Scriptures or the Old Testament, you know, it seems like, in fact, not only should you hate your enemies, but you should get rid of them down to the last woman, child, and livestock."
So you don't really have a category for what many students like to refer to as a false religion?
I think I do, but it's not based on the categories of any particular religion. Usually false religion, you know, a superstition is a religion that someone other than I believe in. And that's the whole kind of, you know, religion. My religion is your superstition. I think that notion of false religion, the Jack Chick tract notion of false religion, which is everything that Jack Chick doesn't believe in, doesn't work. I think if your religion leads you to go out and harm other people or to behave in ways that are hurtful, hateful, you need to go back and review your scriptures and the teachings of your religious tradition, because I'm sure somewhere in there will be the finger wagging at you saying you're not doing it right.
I recently saw an interview of a fellow down in Alabama who was a truck salesman, and his advertising logo was God's Guns and Trucks. And he was asked the question, what gun would Jesus buy, as though to trip him up? It's difficult to see how there's an answer to that question in many cases. But then, like you say, that's what stirs things up again. I once heard a metaphor for what you were describing earlier. Most religious traditions start with a volcanic eruption, and then the lava cools and you have the incrustation that people try to preserve. And I don't know if that metaphor fits. And then every now and then it erupts again and you have great waves or great awakenings or revivals or whatever you want to call it.
You set off a big firecracker and then people stand around and want to preserve the burned out remains of...
Yep. Well, let's go back to this topic of what counts as a world religion. You mentioned earlier that typically it's the existence of a scripture and a number of adherents. Is that?
I think those are two criteria. Those are two pretty good rules of thumb.
Jainism certainly doesn't have a very large following. It does have a scripture, right?
It oftentimes doesn't make the cut of world religions.
Sometimes doesn't.
So, and if it does, it gets a half of a chapter that it shares with Sikhism, or a third of a chapter that it shares with the Baha'i faith. So
I understand worldwide Judaism is not that much more populous than Jainism.
No, not at all. Or Sikhism. I think there may actually be more Sikhs in the world than there are Jews at this point.
In terms of historical influence.
Oh, absolutely.
It's different.
You know, you wouldn't have Christianity and Islam. You know, there are Christians and Muslims in the audience who may take issue with this, but I don't think you'd have Christianity and Islam if you hadn't had Judaism first.
Well, what about those that are intercontinental on multiple continents, have scriptures? Take, for example, Mormonism.
Well, I would say Mormonism's an interesting one because I would consider that a subset of Christianity. And I think a lot of textbooks consider it a subset of Christianity.
It's not like Sikhism.
Right. Well, I'll hesitate before I give a definitive answer to that because there are some textbooks, and I believe the Indian Constitution as well, that seems to – the Indian Constitution, if I remember correctly, implies that Sikhism is a subset of Hinduism. I think it also implies that Jainism is a subset of Hinduism, and there are scholars who agree with those.
Well, Vaishnavite Hinduism considers Christianity
a subset of Hinduism.
Jesus is one of Vishnu's avatars.
Absolutely. So there is something to be said about, again, a world religion should have some kind of global impact. What I discovered interesting, I was going into my first religions of the East, and I like to make little quips to make this stuff interesting from the get-go. And it hit me that every world religion is an Asian religion. So there's something all the world religions have in common. Christianity came out of Palestine. Islam came out of Saudi Arabia. Judaism came out of Palestine.
We have this contest over what counts as
As Asia. But I mean, in that sense, we really do have all of the world religions have their roots somewhere between the Mediterranean and the Pacific Ocean. All the religions of Europe, if they exist, they exist in kind of a reinvented, reconstituted form. Native American religions, African religions, South American religions, Australian Aboriginal religions, all of these faith traditions. Almost none of them get counted as world religions.
In the interest of sponsoring religious literacy, let's just take a few quick questions and quick answers.
Pop
them out. Are either Buddhism and Taoism religions, and why?
Yes and no. In particularly with Taoism, I mean, Taoism, even in the Chinese, there's a distinction made between Dao Jia and Dao Zhao, which is the Taoist philosophy and Taoist religion. So even within China, they make a distinction between philosophical Taoism and religious Taoism.
Do you have to believe in God to be religious?
Not at all.
Are there any religions that don't?
Arguably Buddhism. Buddhism, especially in the West, describes itself as a non-theistic tradition. And I've typically heard that explained as, well, it means that your ultimate source of salvation is not outside of yourself. Because if you go into a Tibetan Buddhist temple, you'll see pictures of multi-armed beings and horribly faced beings and all these different characters. And you think, well, if they're not gods, what are they?
Bodhisattvas.
Bodhisattvas, or even deities. They're even called deities. And again, well, deity versus God. And so the case that's made is that God, as we understand that word, is an external, transcendent power. And so if we appreciate that God can also mean something internal, immanent, maybe Buddhists believe in God.
We have about 10 minutes left, and if you would like to get a call in to our guest on the topic of world religions and issues related to teaching it, you can call in at 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455. What's the oldest religion in the world?
I think we can – well, according to Islam, it would be Islam because Islam was the religion that was written on Adam's heart. But according to the historical record, I think it's a toss-up between what we call Hinduism and what we call Judaism. That the roots of both of those traditions extend back into antiquity and possibly into prehistory. So both of those scriptures are, you know, predate the Christian era by at least 1,000 years.
Not Brahmanism? Ancient, early Hinduism?
No, I see Brahmanism as a later development in more around the 6th century. So it would be part of Hinduism. You mentioned earlier that, you know, according to the Vaishnavite Hindus, even Christianity is a form of Hinduism. Hinduism is such an all-encompassing term that there are traditions in India that are part of what we now call Hinduism that go back
It's kind of
a
like
long way.
Alice's Restaurant.
Right.
Where you can
get anything you
want. We have a caller on line one. Hello, you're on Keeping the Faith. Question or comment?
I have a question, actually. First of all, let me preface it. I am a practicing Christian, but I'm also a scientist. And I have heard a number of times that people refer to science as a world religion. I've also heard some individual suggest that atheism is a religion. Can you provide distinctions between those types of concepts and, I suppose, the more traditional world religions? Thank you very much.
Yeah, that's a fantastic question. I do think that science is a worldview. that science does have philosophical assumptions that come along with it that make it, in that sense, akin to a religion, that it has a coherent, self-consistent worldview with suppositions and all of those things. I think what makes science not religion is that religion deals with the distinction between the sacred and the profane. I hesitate to talk about supernatural because not all religions want to go that route, mm-hmm. or God. But there is a sense that there are two ways of experiencing the world within religions, the profane, worldly way and the sacred way. And if anybody calls in and asks what the difference is between the sacred and the profane, the definitions, I read Mircea Eliade's book on the sacred and the profane several times, and his distinction is very tautological. You know, the sacred is that which is not profane. So that's the case where the student says you have to believe to understand it. You have to have an intimation of the sacred to understand really the distinction there between sacred and profane. But in answer to your question, I think the difference is the lack of that distinction, sacred and profane.
We have a caller from Savoy, line two. You're on Keeping the Faith. Question or comment?
Yes, I've really enjoyed the conversation with you guys. And I just wondered if the guest could comment on animism in all those different countries that he mentioned and that belief as a world religion.
Animism, the belief that everything or every object, every living thing, every non-living thing has a spirit or a soul. I think if we're going to accept the notion that Christianity is not a monolithic idea, we really have to approach animism that way and recognize that animism is almost a catch-all term in the study of religion that encompasses lots of traditions whose views of those spirits can be really different. I don't know if that's... If you have anything to add to that, Don, I...
Well, we have. Let's come back to it.
Sure,
we have another caller. Make sure we get them in. This someone is all the way from Indiana on line four. Hello, you're calling from a long distance away. Question or comment?
Yes, I have a comment and questions. Ishmael spoke to Hagar by an angel, and the angel stated Ishmael is going to be a wild man. Hand's going to be against every man, every man's hand's going to be against him. Now then later, after Sarah's death, Abraham took another wife, Keturah. She had Zimran, Jokshan, Midian, Ishbar, and Shua. Now later, Abraham sent all these and also sons of concubines far to the east because he didn't want them to make big trouble with Isaac. Now, is this all more or less... Because Abraham is a special man of God, and he foresaw all that was coming in the future as what's happening now. All these people are, they are sons of Abraham, and I consider them equal to the Jewish faith. Now, am I wrong?
Thank you for your call, Jason.
I assume when you say that they are also children of Abraham, you're referring to Arabs. And that is an interesting thing. My wife and I were talking about this morning, that one of the interesting obfuscations in our cultural portrayal of Islam, there's a double whammy. One portrayal is that all Muslims are terrorists. And we can look to Northern Ireland and say, well, by that logic, all Christians, Protestant, and Catholic are terrorists.
The Crusades.
But I think that the more salient point is that not all Arabs are Muslims, and not all Muslims are Arabs. So even though Islam arose in Saudi Arabia, and even though most Arabs are Islamic, and the Quran is written in Arabic, the most populous Muslim nation is Indonesia. And some of the larger Muslim populations in the world are in Pakistan and Bangladesh and India and China. So most Muslims aren't Arabs. And another interesting thing is that there are Arab Christians, like Palestinians. A lot of Palestinians are Christians. So I do think that if we're looking, Abrahamic traditions, Arabs, Jews, they're both Semitic people. They have these common roots. And I don't think that the Hebrew Bible is looking forward and predicting the strife between Arabs and Jews, Muslims and Christians. I don't think it's doing that.
Okay, we have a thank you for your question. We have another call from Avon, Indiana. You're on line one. Question or comment for our guest?
Yes, sir. Good evening.
Good evening.
Today, the way religion is being mass marketed on the electronic media, mm-hmm. it sure gives the feeling that it's nothing, you know, but a big Ponzi scheme and a financial ripoff. How far back into history can we go for that?
Look at the pyramids. I think that in some sense...
The pyramids?
Yeah.
This is interesting. Tell me about that.
No, I think that you know, some anthropologists would trace the origins of religion back to the agricultural revolution and say that the moment that you had a surplus and you had some people in control of that surplus, you had the ability to get, if not donations out of people, you had the ability to get work out of them. So I think that religion as a means of organizing society and benefiting certain classes of society is as old as the phenomenon of religion itself. What I think is cool about religion is that religion is one of the few institutions that continually coughs up antidotes to that mindset, that constantly throws up figures who challenge those ideas of hierarchy and domination and repression. So I think that the idea that religion has been used to milk people of their money is as old as religion itself. But I think that religion has also had the teachings to counteract that.
So do political parties.
I guess that's true. Exactly.
So do,
and I don't know that they have the teachings to counteract it. So.
Well, they do have platforms. All right. Well, we have just a few minutes left here. Let's. I know this will be impossible for you, but try to do these in one sentence. It won't happen, but let's just give it a shot.
Guilty as charged.
We tried the oldest religion in the world. What about the oldest scripture in the world?
Rig Veda, mm-hmm. I would say, and there are one or two authors who are insinuating that the Rig Veda is really old because of astronomical references in the text. Mm-hmm. I don't think that they're too credible, but it's probably the oldest text out there.
Roughly, what date?
Oh my gosh! Like
just more than 400 or 500 years.
I'm thinking like 2200 BCE mm-hmm. is some of the oldest material in there.
What's the oldest god in the world?
The god. Shiva, I'll say, based on Shiva is the Hindu god of destruction. And there are clay seals that have been found in a place called Mohenjo-Daro in what's now the Indus River Valley. And they have impressions in clay of a cow-headed figure who's proto-Shiva.
What's the fastest growing religion in the world? You already mentioned the
Islam,
US.
I think. And might be the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. I know they're growing fast, too.
Right. Well, we are just about out of time here. Jason, thank you very much
for
coming.
It was
delightful. Quite a number of calls. I can't remember that many before. We've been talking with Professor Jason Merrick, who teaches Great Religions of the World, Religion 102 at Parkland College, and has been doing so for the past 5 years. Thank you all for joining us, and next week we'll be talking about the new atheists. So join us again next week, same time, same place. Thank you.
You've been listening to Keepin' the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
Religion was supposed to be dying, but God's making a comeback in countries around the world, from Russia to China to Turkey. I'm Jim Fleming. Next time on To the Best of Our Knowledge, we'll get the story behind this global revival of faith. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Sunday evening at 7. Monday morning on Focus 580 at 10 o'clock, the topic will be home maintenance, and our guest will be Scott Spies from the Spies Home Inspection Service. It's a topic we feature every month, and we invite your questions on everything from windows and siding to roofing and gutters to attics and basements, just about anything that goes into the single-family home. If you're thinking of making some changes or something needs to be repaired, you are welcome to call. I'm David Inge, the host. It's Focus 580, Monday at 10.
We're broadcasting from Campbell Hall for Public Telecommunication, thanks to the generosity of Alice and Robert Campbell.
This is WILL AM 580.